Thank you, Claire. I just got this morning, and they really wanted to do that, so thank you. And we have been coming here for just over a year now, and I want to thank you for welcoming us and giving the opportunity to serve here today. My watch just told me I have a high heart rate, so there you go. Let me just make sure my tech is set up here. And that should make it good. There we are. It is traditional, if you've been in church for a while, to talk about the prodigal son on Father's Day, and I won't be doing that. But I kind of am. Ooh. So I'm going to start with something that's personal and sad, but it helps give you context to what I'm going to be sharing today, and that is I basically grew up without a father, and so obviously all of us have a biological father, and so when that word, father, honestly, I really don't know what it means, and it's been a journey for me in order to figure that out and try to discover what that is. So if you have a good dad, awesome. Like, I couldn't be more happy for you. And sometimes I get feelings of anger inside when I hear about how great someone's dad is, because it's a reminder of how much I've lost or have not had. But ultimately, of course, like, that is great. So if you don't have a great dad, it's a lot of work to both deal with that and try to figure out what should the word father look like. So a very quick summation of my biological father and kind of my relationship with him is that he was involved in my creation, okay? And that's kind of where it ends. So Father's Day has been a struggle for me, and I have to make that dreaded phone call. I feel, you know, the fifth commandment, you got to honor your father and mother and such. And so, you know, I make that phone call, but it's difficult. He says that he cares, but I can't really point to any proof of that. And so that, again, is a struggle. So he's not been there for me. He is interested in himself. And so he's not active in my life, but the relationship is not antagonistic. There were years in my teenage years where I was very angry at him. That lasted until my mid-20s. And then we reconciled, and again, it was unfortunate that I had to do kind of 95% of that. But relationships can be thought of like plants, and the best word I can use to describe this relationship is dead. It's just, there's just no water coming to it from either side. He has been there in extreme emergencies. So there was this one situation, me and my friends were going to go to the X in Toronto, and a ride fell through, and I called him, and he showed up, and he took me there. And so that was great. I still remember that. It was over 30 years ago. And so I do remember that. So I'm not bringing any of this up so you feel badly for me or anything. Maybe some of you can identify with these feelings. But I bring this up because our view of our fathers affects our view of God, period. Like, that, there's so much science and you know, therapy and whatever that will tell you about that. And so what is your view of God the Father, right? Is it like what I just shared, where it's like he made me not terribly interested there in emergencies? If we're honest, that's a very functional view of God the Father that I know a lot of Christians have. I was listening to an audiobook or a podcast. I don't remember the reference. It doesn't matter that much. But this really struck me in it. And that is, we don't struggle to think about God's intelligence being beyond ours. But we do struggle to think his love is beyond our parents' love. So that's my struggle. I have learned a few things about God as a good, good father that I think are worth sharing with you this morning, and that's what I'm going to be sharing. The Bible uses metaphors for us, and Dean was very helpful in telling us what's a metaphor versus a simile and such. So the Bible uses a lot of metaphors, and the primary ones that he uses for us is sheep. And I'm sure you love that one. And the other one that is very predominant is he calls us children. So I want to really zoom in on that one. For those that don't have kids, I will tell you, because now I do have kids, that kids are the most obvious teaching instrument God could ever give you, like ever, to help you kind of understand things from another perspective, maybe his perspective. So it's one of the reasons I wanted to have children. Like, I knew there was something missing in my life in this whole father relationship thing, and I figured that I would probably learn something about God the Father through having children, and so that was a motivation for me. And so my kids have taught me a lot, and that's what I'm going to be sharing with you. So who are these kids that I'm talking about? So here's a picture of us, and my firstborn is Claire, and she is 13. And then Avery came along 2 years later, because that's how you do it, and she is now 11. And then James snuck in right there at 10. He's 11 months from Avery. And so they are thrilled to be your sermon illustrations today. I think that's every pastor kid's fear. So let's start with this. The kids are messy. Kids make mistakes, and you don't have to be around them long in order to see that. So Avery really likes helping in the kitchen. That's a very middle child kind of thing to do. And so we're letting her use the microwave in order to do things. And what happens when she pushes 20 minutes instead of 2 minutes? We're going to wreck the plastic or whatever, right? And so I know when she's in the kitchen and she's doing these things for the first time, second time, whatever, I know mistakes are going to be made. I know things are going to get wrecked. But I still let her try, right? Because doing is part of the learning process. God gave us the capacity to speak. The animals kind of grunt at each other, and there's maybe whale songs and such, but there's not a lot of speech that is going on there, but we have the capacity to speak. And we can use that kindly or meanly. God knows that with this speech, we're going to hurt people and wreck stuff. But it's part of the maturing process to be able to try it out. So I hit this song on Spotify, and it struck me more so the title than the actual song, which was, "So It's Your First Time on Earth Too?" And that really helps, like, as I deal with teenage high school issues, can you believe so-and-so did this? Can you believe they said that? That song title, well, it's their first time on Earth, too. So, like, they're figuring it out as well, and they're going to get it wrong as we go along. So the Bible is full of dad talks, which is wisdom for handling the adversity that we're going to face in this life, frankly, from each other. So it's kind of like he's telling us so that we don't get upset when it happens. In fact, kind of expect it. And so all the Bible verses are going to be up on the screen, so you don't have to flip around. So 1 Corinthians 6:7, to have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? That is really a different way of looking at it. It's like, but she said, and I want to, and whatever, right? And it's like, God's like, just be wrong. Like, it's going to happen. So you don't necessarily have to fight back, right? You're going to be wronged. Move on. In James, he says, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Isn't that great kid advice? Like, I could tell my kids that when they're in the back seat. Like, be slow to speak and slow to anger. And in Ephesians, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. So those are just a few of the dad talks. Kids fail. Kids make promises that they're never going to keep. Right? I don't know how many you've had of these. Let me carry it. I promise I won't spill it. I promise. Right? And what happens? Right? I totally know they will. But maybe this is the time they don't. Like, again, this is how they learn. So you give them the thing, and you fill the cup only halfway, and you let them carry it. Okay? So what's the alternative? They don't do anything ever. Right? That's the alternative. So we got to take the messiness as we go. And so this is how they learn. So Jesus demonstrated this really well with Peter. So Peter says, though all these dudes fall away, okay, I will never fall away. I promise I will not fall away. And Jesus is like, yeah, I tell you this very night before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. And Peter said to him, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And all the disciples are like, yeah, me too, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what is Peter doing here? He's making a little kid promise, like, I won't do it. And what did Jesus do with this? He turned it into a teaching moment. He forgave Peter and said, go feed my sheep, and moved on. The relationship was healed and moved on. Kids don't trust each other. Maybe they shouldn't. Like, they've learned this from good experience, but they don't trust each other. So when you use kids as messengers, it's really, you're taking a gamble. So I'm upstairs, James is upstairs, Avery's downstairs, and I say to James, okay, let's clean this house up, right? It's time to clean this house. And go tell your sister Avery downstairs. So dutiful James runs downstairs and tells Avery, it's time to clean up, Avery. No, I don't think so. You're not the boss of me, right? She doesn't believe him, like, at all, right? And I think this is a great illustration for how we listen to one another, again, in the spiritual sense, right? And so let's break down Avery's listening to James. So James says, Dad wants to clean the house. Now, is this in line with Dad's character? Does Dad like a clean house? Yes, Dad likes a clean house. Okay, so it's likely to be true. Secondly, is that something Dad would say? Has he said something like that before? Let's clean this house? Yes, he has. So, okay, that's maybe something that he would say. It lines up with his purposes. Okay, but would Dad really want me to clean the house, right? Like, maybe other people clean the house. But me, Avery, would he want me to clean the house? Well, has he ever asked me to clean the house before? Again, actually, yes, he has. Okay, so maybe actually this does line up with what my father said. So what's the alternative? Is that I have to go and tell every single child, every single time, every single thing to do, right? Or should they believe one another, right? And so I should be able to pass a message on to James. James was in close proximity to me. James was in a better place to listen to the Father than Avery was. It's not like she was doing something wrong. James was closer. And I gave the message to James, and he passed it on to the rest of the children. This is God's heart for us as a church. As his kids, he wants us to listen to one another. And when he gives a message to one of us, he wants us to take that seriously. Now, of course, you need to test the spirits, right, and make sure that this is legit. Again, I gave you a little example of how you can do that. Has he said this before? Is this in line with his character, etc.? Early in our marriage, Catherine was given this message from the Lord that was really significant and required us to do some very significant things. And I was like praying, okay, God, if this is really true, then tell me. I want to know too, right? Husband and wife should be united in this thing. Tell me too. And did he? Nope. And so I'm now like, well, what do I do? Because now I have to decide if she heard from God or not, and how do we figure this out? So I started investigating it, and I was overwhelmingly like, oh, yeah, okay, God spoke to her. And that was a big breakthrough moment for me. It was like, oh, God doesn't have to tell both of us. He can just tell one of us, and they can pass the message along. So here in John, it says, you know, dear friends, do not believe everyone who claims to speak by the Spirit. You must test them to see if the Spirit they have comes from God. So check if it's against the Father's will, and check what he's done before. I do prayers with my kids almost every night. That's my responsibility, and so we go through maybe what you've heard, the ACTS process, ACTS. And so A is adoration. You say something good, positive, true about God. T or C is confession. Confess something that you did wrong, morally wrong. And T is thankfulness, and S is supplication, which the kids have no idea what that word means. It's just ask for stuff. So S stands for stuff. So I want to focus in on the S, supplication side of that. And so over these years, you know, like I said, the youngest is 10. So if you take 10 times, let's say 300, I've heard at least 3,000 little kid prayers. And those little kid prayers, they ask for ridiculous things in the S, right? And so one example is one of the kids took one of the other kids' stuffies, and so they were coming. This is not during prayer time, I'm sorry. They came to me and said, "That they took my stuffie, I want you to give them 100 spanks." Not a spank, 100 spanks. What's the extra 99 spanks? Oh, they're going to learn. They're really going to know not to take my stuffy. That's that 100 spanks. That's what we need, right? Or a timeout for a year. These are things they come to me with. Like, oh, she dropped my milk. Like, 100-year timeout, right? And so for the tiniest of infractions that happen in our home, they want huge punishments to occur on who? Others, right? Not themselves. Like, no, I need grace. But the others, they got to get it. So I listen to them. I don't do what they ask, like at all. But I understand what they're saying, which is, I've been wronged. I want some sense of justice. It's not okay what just happened to me. It's not okay. And so I can take that and turn it into something. And we have this. And this is what Jesus said, this is what Romans said about it. So, likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray for as we ought. But the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. There's someone in between us translating 100 spanks into, I would like some justice here, or at least some healing of this pain. Like I said, I've heard a lot of little kid prayer supplications. And the number one, by far, of all the things they have ever asked God for is 1,000 guinea pigs. They love guinea pigs. They are so cute and fluffy. This is their goal. James wants to wake up in the morning. He has an IKEA bed. He's high up, so he wants to get down the ladder and step onto guinea pigs and have them kind of crowd surf him to the kitchen to get his breakfast. That is what he prays for each night, is that number of guinea pigs. So does he want it? Absolutely he wants this. There is no doubt in my mind or his mind that he wants this. Is it good for him? No, it's not good for any of us, okay? So wants it and not good for them. If my kids were in charge of the pocketbook, all of our money would go towards these three things: toys, tacos, and ice cream. That to them is pretty much life. Toys, tacos, and ice cream. And if I'm honest, it's kind of how I spend the money, too. So how often do my petitions and your petitions to God fall into toys, tacos, and ice cream? And how many times is God saying, yeah, that's never going to happen? Another thing that I've learned from the kids is they have no sense of time. No clue. James is at this time 4, and he's really sad because his fire truck batteries ran out. He can't hit that button and annoy us anymore. So I've learned a dad secret for new dads. You can solve most of your little kids' problems with two things: super glue and fresh batteries. So that got me through the first 3 to 4 years. Now it becomes much harder. I've seen that, and I'm sure it gets even worse. Okay, so his batteries are out. So we take apart the fire truck and take the batteries out. I put them in the charger thing. I plug it in, and he's staring at it. Are they done yet? And I'm like, no. Like, it takes a while in order for this to happen. And he's like, how long? And I said, at least an hour. He has no clue what an hour is. And then I'm like, okay, it's going to take a long time. He has no idea what a long time is. And finally I say, after lunch, okay? The batteries will be ready after lunch. And now he kind of gets it. He's like, I don't know when lunch is, but I know that that's a concrete thing that I can look forward to. And then the batteries will be ready right after lunch. So precision and time as a dad is kind of meaningless. It doesn't work with the kids. So we have to use event-based time. First this, then that. If you look at how the Bible's written, that's exactly the kind of timing it uses. First this, then that, and then this. We've been waiting a long time for this second coming, right? And there's no specificity. And I'm a medievalist, and I study a lot of medieval things. And as really funny aside, that one of the bishops, a very smart guy, I forget his name right now, but one of the bishops, he was like, Jesus said, no one knows the day or the time of my return. And he said, the year. We can guess the year and put all kinds of effort into the year because Jesus didn't say we wouldn't know the year. So is this guy getting it? No, clearly he's not. So the Bible uses a lot of event-based timing. Maybe you've noticed this, that kids don't want to wait for anything. So batteries to charge, Christmas presents to arrive, etc. They want things now. So sometimes they come to me and they ask me for things, and then they're shocked that it isn't done in 5 minutes. And I have to explain that thing that you want done is a process. There's like a lot of things to coordinate in order for that to occur. It doesn't just happen immediately. And so how true of that is our Father, that we ask him for things, for a relationship to heal, or for a business deal to go through. There's a lot of moving pieces. And I want the things immediately, of course, but there's a lot of moving pieces he has to work with in order to coordinate it. And when you wait upon the Lord for him to do those things, it can be really special and amazing. I can't believe it all came together at this moment in so many ways. But I will say the little kids have something over us, which is that they have a sense of eternity, right? They have no sense of time. So they have all the time in the world to do things. They're building a blanket fort. They think they have years to build the blanket fort. It is so elaborate and it goes on forever. And the first step is, of course, to gather every blanket in the home and then to build the blanket fort, right? But they don't realize that suddenly it's lunch or you have a dancing lesson or whatever it happens to be. And they're like, oh, I ran out of time for this thing. So for us, it's really hard to think in terms of eternity, that this time that we have here now is the time where we're building the blanket forts and we think blanket forts is the most important thing and we have all the time in the world to build these blanket forts and stuff. And it's like, no, this is just a temporary thing and we're moving on to the big thing, the big long time where you have time to do things. And so if you read Isaiah, Ezekiel, Revelations, you'll see that, wow, there's like a lot of time in order to do things later. But when it comes to kids, we have to teach them that things happen in X number of sleeps. And that's their way of judging things. The next thing, I call it training. I'm going to talk about discipline and punishment, but there's a reason that I don't say punishment, and it's because it's training. We train our kids, and God is training us as well. And so the first thing is, when it comes to kids, it's repetition. Over and over and over again, I have to tell them to flush the toilet, to brush their teeth. Again, how many times have I put these kids to bed? Well, 10 years times 365 is how many times they've gone to bed. And they still don't seem to know that putting on pajamas and brushing teeth are connected. They're the same thing. They're like, oh, well, you never told me to brush my teeth. And so it's like, ah. So I spend a lot of time repeating myself, and God spends a lot of time repeating himself. Have you seen the prophets? The prophets are dad fed up and just saying, why didn't you do what I told you to do? Malachi is just one example. Why aren't you bringing the offerings in like you're supposed to, right? So, punishment. I want to give good things to my kids. Things like having a cousin over for a sleepover. But they misbehave. They do things wrong. They break the rules, etc. Okay? And so I sometimes say, I love you enough to punish you, right? Like, it's not okay, this behavior. It's not okay now. It's not okay for future you. When I lay down that punishment, I then do everything I can to have them succeed. When we have to enact it, like no sleepover, we're sad too, right? Like, the whole family doesn't get to have that cousin over, and so, not just the kid, right? So in a sense, the home or the world is a little bit darker because of that misbehavior. And so God is sad in the world when we misbehave, because there's these good things that he's like, yeah, you're not ready. We can't do that. I can't do that right after you did this. So the really sad news is that we mostly learn from pain. A lot of psychology and science behind that. We do not learn from pleasure. We learn from pain. I work in video games. I consult in video games. There's a lot of psychology around this. And I can tell you that the player, when they're playing the video game, responds to their character being injured more so than getting a treasure chest or something else in the game. So we, as video game designers, we do place in rewards, but not as much as we put in the painful points where you can hurt your character. So in Hebrews 12, it says, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. If you're training someone, Olympian, professional football player, whatever, if you're training someone, you follow a customized plan, right? Like, the caloric intake or the particular exercises or the stretches is specific to that person. It's not a blanket thing. Everybody should do this, okay? So we customize the discipline out of love so that this is the best thing for you now as we grow. Israel was a bad kid, okay? You can read Kings and Chronicles. Israel was a bad kid. And God gave them a 70-year exile. And it was kind of good for them. Because after that 70 years of being in Babylon and such, that before that exile, they really struggled with idolatry all the time. That's all you read, is that they had an Asherah pole and they had Baal and they had these calves and they had these extra altars and whatever. Just, you go through the Ten Commandments and it's every single one, tick, 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 they broke it, right? And they come back from the exile, and what are they? Fierce monotheists. No other gods, ever, of any kind. We don't see them struggling with that anymore. And that's the moment Jesus shows up. Surprise! The Godhead has multiple parts. Once the polytheism's gone, then the next part can come out and say, actually, there's this Trinity and such, right? But he had to get rid of the polytheism first. Could Jesus have come sooner? Interesting thought exercise. Israel, obviously when Jesus came, Israel was under the rule of Rome. I think there's a world where obedient, Davidic kings following God, maybe Jesus comes and they aren't under the rule of Rome and that they're under self-rule and such. Maybe. Unpunishment. So, in Orlando is a burger chain that is founded by a Michelin star chef. The Michelin star chef was fed up with what life is like. If any of you watched The Bear, she's fed up with how life is in fine dining and all the work in the kitchen and everything. She's like, we're killing ourselves. This is terrible. I'm going to go make burgers. And she makes the best burgers that I've ever had. Okay, so the place is called Adler's. I love it. It's called Adler's in Orlando. So I had a pastor friend take me there. I'm like, this is so fantastic. I love this. What do I want to do? I want to share it with my son. So I go to James. I'm like, hey, we're going to go and we're going to share this food together. And then he did something really rotten that afternoon. And I'm like, I can't take him out for these burgers, whatever, after what he's just done. And James, we're not going to Adler's. Can't have the burger. Now, I don't get the burger too, and that sucks. But James, we're not going to Adler's. And I tell you, the rest of that day, I'm trying to find ways for him to succeed to get the Adler burger back, right? If there's some great thing that he can do, maybe for one of the other kids or for me around the house, if he grabbed a mop and started mopping the whole thing, I'd be like, you know, maybe this put these burger things back on the menu, right? And so I'm looking for ways for him to succeed, and I think that's the way God the Father is with us as well. The Father does punish. We see that in situations like in Kings, again in Chronicles. But he's looking for ways to not punish. And so God gets this bad rap, Old Testament, fire and brimstone, he wants to punish everybody and such. That's not accurate. Okay, let's look at this with Jezebel and the killing of Naboth. So if you don't know the story, Ahab, worst king ever, right? And it says, this guy's worse than all the other bad kings put together. This guy's awful. And he murders somebody. What does he murder him for? To get some more land. King has lots of land, really like this land, kills the guy, gets the land. And this is what God says. And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, you have killed and also taken possession, or have you killed and also taken possession? And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick your own blood. And when Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his flesh. That's a really itchy, very uncomfortable thing. So he puts that on and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went about dejectedly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite and saying, have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster in his days. But in his son's days, I will bring disaster upon his. Wait, what? This guy murdered. He's the worst king ever. And God's like, yeah, I'm going to give you another chance on this. Okay, so this Ahab, this is the guy who was at Mount Carmel. I used to think it was Caramel, but Mount Carmel. And he saw the fire come down. He saw that God was superior to Baal and all the things that they were worshiping. Ahab already had many chances, and here he murders someone, and God is going to punish him, and then he takes it back. What is up with that? Is that just? Is that right? Is that a king who's ruling correctly? It doesn't make sense until I look at it through the Father who took Michelin burgers away and then is like, okay, you've done pretty good here. Okay, we're going to do that. So grace doesn't make sense. But it's the way that we can train our kids. Everyone seems to talk about God keeping people out of heaven. You know, if you don't confess, you're going to hell, etc. God wants as many of his kids to be in heaven with him as possible, so he can enjoy it together with all of us. The song goes, how deep the Father's love for us, how vast beyond all measure. How much more is our Father's love for us than my love for my son and Michelin star burgers? Right? We can see that in John 3:16. For God so loved the world, or his kids, he gave his one and only son, so that everyone who believes in him will not perish but have eternal life. Let's talk about maturity. These are ducks. Ducks? Well done. A baby duck becomes self-sufficient in 8 to 10 weeks. Parents, can you imagine if it was only 8 to 10 weeks and like, we're good, right? You are ready for the world. 8 to 10 weeks, I could totally do 8 to 10 weeks, okay? But a human takes 21 years. Some humans a little longer than that, but 21 years, okay? And we're talking about full development of the prefrontal cortex and such. So that is a long, big commitment, 21 years. Okay, in business, we have startups, especially in startups, and we have this term for the kind of unpaid work that you put in just to get the thing going and get this thing off the ground so that it can kind of sustain itself, and it's called sweat equity, okay? So you get sweat equity. So 21 years is a lot of sweat equity in these kiddos. And older parents, Are you ever really done? Are you done? No, you're never really done. Okay, so it goes way beyond the 21 years. So maybe there's a message here. God's trying to tell us that we're never really done maturing. There's always a way that he can teach us more. So what's the goal in parenting? If you ask the culture, it's avoidance of pain and avoidance of sorrow. Full stop. Parents will do anything and fight you really hard so their kids can avoid pain and sorrow. But really, is avoidance of pain really the goal? In the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, it talks about beginning with the end in mind. He didn't invent that. God begins with the end in mind. And I'm halfway through the 21 years, so there's a lot more for me to, of course, learn. But what does success look like when we hit this 21-year point? Treat each other well and find their calling. Okay? And solve problems on their own. Having them solve problems on their own is the best for child development and self-worth. It's huge. If you do everything for the kid, they will not have any self-worth. They have to do the things. So I had a kid doing a chore, and they asked why they had to do it. And my answer was, I could do everything for you, but I won't, because then you'll get all the benefits, right? And none of the growth. This is how God is. He could write that sermon. He could deliver that casserole. He could heal that wound. He could solve that financial dilemma. Why does he let these difficult things happen? In preparation for our eventual trip to Mars, they create biospheres. And the biospheres are people locked in to a small ecological biome, and they try to grow their own food and breathe their own oxygen and everything and not have anything outside of it. See if we can pull it off on Mars. So in biosphere 2, they had a jungle section. And in that jungle section, they had jungle trees, and the jungle trees sprouted, and because there's no bugs, pests, anything like that, the things grew up real fast and real great and real straight. And then they fell over. They couldn't figure it out. They're like, is there something wrong with the seeds? You know, we didn't genetically modify them. Like, what is going on? Soil's okay. Soil's deep enough. All those things. You know what they were missing? Wind. They were missing wind. Trees need wind. The kind of wind that makes them almost fall over makes them deepen and strengthen the roots. If you don't have wind in your child or in your life, you won't deepen and grow those roots, and you will fall over like the jungle trees. Avery likes to cook. I already told you that. Hey, Avery, you want to make dinner? Yeah. I decide the menu. I go to the store. I buy the ingredients. I put them away so that they're in the right places. At the right time, I prep and cut. I set things to boil. I know how long things are supposed to be going. I'll watch over everything to make sure it's done. And Avery will throw in some ingredients and do some of the stirring. And when we get to the table, she'll say, I made dinner for all of you. How much truer is that about God? He is the God who made the world and everything in it. He himself gives life and breath to everything, and he satisfies every need. How many times do I take credit for doing something like I built that house or completed that degree, I won that big contract, etc., when really God had prepped all the stuff and I'm just taking credit for throwing a few ingredients in and maybe stirring? As you know, my kids like guinea pigs. We have guinea pigs. And when you get the family pet, what do the kids do? They name it. They name the pet. That's their job. And when they name the pet, now the parents are forever calling the pet by that name. And we're pretty familiar with that, and I think it's an example of God's loving kindness as a father. So in Genesis 2, now out of the ground, the Lord had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. Adam got to name the family pets. And I like to think of this picture that it's all a bunch of like baby animals and he's, you know, naming each one of them. It's a super cute scenario. So you're pretty familiar with that one. But here's another example where God does that, where he uses the children's language. And that is in the stars. And so we, or the Greeks, named these stars the bear, Orion, and Pleiades. And in Job, those are the words that he uses. Who made the bear and Orion and the Pleiades and the chambers of the south? God uses our words in order to communicate with us. Okay. So let's wrap this up. In Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms, no one would ever pray our Father to God. He's a king. He's in charge. Jesus shows up, and first, he calls God his Father. I should be about my Father's business in the temple. Then, in Luke 2, yeah, sorry, that was Luke 2. Then later, he starts talking about God as our Father. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see the good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. But like all good revolutions, it's actually bringing back an old idea. God as Father is actually right there from the beginning. In Exodus, it says, "There you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son." He's presenting himself as Father of Israel. In Deuteronomy, "Do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is not he your Father who created you and who made and established you?" So how much has God the Father done for us just to be able to meet like this? There are times, I work at home, I work a lot, my kids are always coming to my office asking me for things, I'm trying to solve things from my office chair most of the time, okay? But there are times where they come in and things are so bad and so terrible, I gotta go there myself and deal with it. And that's what the cross is God the Father saying, it's so bad down there. You kids are behaving so poorly to each other, I gotta get down there and make this right. So today is Father's Day. What does God want? He wants his kids to be a reflection of him today. When they see you, they should see a good, good father. When they see me, they can say, oh, I see your dad in you. That's what they should be saying. And lastly, he wants us to get along, to stop fighting and bickering with one another. This is what Jesus said as he was about to leave. This is how people will know that I came, how you love one another. He wants some gratitude. He doesn't need it, but he kind of wants some gratitude. And then he moved into saying, I want you now to pray like this. Our Father in heaven, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And so this is what I'm challenging myself to go and do today. How can I honor my true Father and make earth a little bit more like heaven? Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, or as my friend says, King Daddy, we thank you that we can gather, we can worship you, we can learn about you, and that we can encourage one another to be more like Jesus. And I pray that we can take that this day. We can honor our fathers and we can honor you in what we do. Amen.